The mindfulness movement took off in 1979 when Jon Kabat-Zinn, known as the father of modern mindfulness, founded a stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts. 40 years on, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Sold, says my next guest, by capitalism to help us cope with the ravages of capitalism. Ronald Purser has written a polemic called McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality. Dr. Purser is a professor of management at the College of Business at San Francisco State University and co-host of the Mindful Cranks podcast. He's also an ordained Korean Zen Dharma teacher. So I asked him about the original concept of mindfulness in Buddhism.
Buddhism is not one particular school. There's many schools of Buddhism. But if we go back to the very early tradition of Buddhism, the Theravada tradition, if we look at the canon and some key text within this tradition, we come across a text called the Satipatthana Sutra, which really means establishing the foundations of mindfulness. And so mindfulness was embedded within a path of spiritual liberation, which included ethical training. And mindfulness was part of training in concentration, and then another training in insight and in developing wisdom and compassion. So it's part of an integrated framework. But the original meaning of mindfulness actually comes from the Sanskrit smriti, or in Pali, sati. And it's been translated in the 19th century, a Welsh Oriental scholar translated it into mindfulness from sati. But sati actually has the meaning of calling to mind, recollecting, bringing something into mind, and bringing into mind certain reflections, certain contemplative reflections, certain instructions, and even doctrines. So in the classic teaching on mindfulness, actually there was no instruction to be in the present moment. Although it does cultivate a presence of mind, but the purpose and function of mindfulness was really to put an end to suffering. And so they differentiated, the canon actually differentiated between two types of mindfulness, which they called right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness, samasati and micca sati. And right mindfulness signified a faculty of mind that would develop and remember skillful actions from the past that would be conducive to wholesome mental states, and avoiding unskillful actions, thoughts, feelings, and so forth. So mindfulness was not just merely a passive or a non-judgmental attention to the present moment, but actually actively engaged in discerning awareness of, and capable of recollecting what was conducive to the reduction of suffering and putting that into practice.
Who's suffering, though?
Oh, everyone's suffering.
And how does that work? I mean, I understand that your objection is that modern mindfulness has become very self-absorbed. But did Buddhism, in whatever form of sati or mindfulness you want to look at, did it extend out into the world?
Did it extend out into the world? Well, that's a really good question. We have to look, it depends on what time period we're talking about in the Buddhist tradition. So if we're going back to the very early tradition, we're looking at a wandering monks. They were living in the forest. Some were in small monasteries, and the practice was really focused on individual salvation. So in many ways, no, I would actually say that the early Buddhist tradition was all about the liberation of the single individual to escape this world, to transcend this world, to get off the wheel of samsara, the wheel of suffering, and not be reincarnated. That was sort of the very early Buddhist tradition. Now, Buddhism has always changed as it's moved from different cultures and different time periods. So we see kind of a whole different reinvention of Buddhism when it moved into China and it moved into Southeast Asia, particularly the Mahayana tradition, which was based on a much more expansive vision of what enlightenment meant. An awakening in that tradition was based on this ideal of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva was someone who took a vow to save all sentient beings. So in other words, you know, it's not just for myself. I'm not just trying to awaken to improve my own lot, but to stick around until I can liberate all sentient beings. That's sort of the ideal.
You're never going to get a Buddhist revolution, though, are you?
No, you're absolutely right. If we look at the, if we try to look to Buddhism for political and social activism, we're not going to find much. And for many reasons. One is the one I just mentioned. It has been focused primarily on a path of individual salvation, retreat from the world, disengagement from the world even.
But hang on a minute. Sorry to interrupt. But isn't that the problem you have with modern mindfulness? That it's too self-absorbed. So in that sense, it's perfectly Buddhist.
Yes and no. Because where modern mindfulness starts, it starts as a therapeutic technique. So it was really not about dissolution of the ego or seeing deeply into the false nature, the illusory nature of a separate self. So Buddhist tradition, its liberative tradition was to see through the delusion that we're separate individuals. Whereas with modern mindfulness, we're really not going that deep into trying to dissolve the sense of self. We're really just trying to offer some temporary palliative relief to individuals in a therapeutic way.
Like eating a raisin very slowly.
Like slowly tasting a raisin. It was kind of like developing more sensory awareness of the present moment and just kind of taking in, washing the dishes, looking at the bubbles, trying to enjoy, you know, everyday moments. But that's very different than, you could say, the liberative pathway of Buddhism. But they're both, as you absolutely hit the nail on the head, they're both inward looking. And I think that's probably part of the problem with where our culture is right now is that I think a reason why modern mindfulness has such appeal is because we're in such a topsy-turvy world. We're in such a world just fraught with uncertainties and precarity and anxieties that there's a real temptation to just tune out and basically drop into our privatized interior worlds. So this turning inward basically then is exactly where the neoliberal political system would like us to be, not to really come out and form solid bonds with other people, start to organize collectively, start to push back and resist a lot of these unjust social systems and so forth. So I think we're at a point now that mindfulness has found itself kind of grafted in Western cultures into medicine and psychology. So it's kind of been under the auspices of a biomedical paradigm, and the biomedical paradigm has a kind of a view that it is very decontextualized in terms of offering individual level medical treatments but it doesn't take into account like community psychology, other disciplines like sociology. It doesn't take into account that, for example, stress is a really good example of how stress has been privatized. Our understanding of stress is something that it's an individual problem of maladaptation to the environment. It's some sort of biological flaw that we inherited from our caveman ancestors, that we have a kind of a flawed biology, a fight-flight system, which now is kind of gone out of whack. And so we have to compensate and mindful up and use mindfulness to try to cope as best we can to the conditions that we find ourselves in. But that's a narrative. That's a dominant narrative of stress, which depoliticizes stress. And it puts the burden and the onus of stress on individuals, takes basically other explanatory narratives off the table. In other words, that stress is in many ways a public health issue. It's generated by structural and material conditions. But those aren't really examined within a kind of the mindfulness communities.
Buddhism didn't really take into account sociology or politics in its long history either. So are you in fact saying mindfulness might be the opiate of the people, but so too is Buddhism, and we shouldn't really have any of them?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I'm saying that we have an opportunity because nothing is cast in stone. I mean, if we look at the history of Buddhism, when it moved from India to China, for example, it took over 600 to 700 years for it really to take root in China and become Chinese. In other words, there's a process of cultural and literary translations that were going on. In the West, Buddhism's been around maybe 100, 150 years at most in the modern Western world. And as far as meditation, mindfulness, that's probably 30 years. So what I'm trying to say is that if we're translating Buddhism for the West, and if we're, you know, really trying to do something with mindfulness that could go beyond just being an individual palliative for stress relief, we can actually be creative and innovative in terms of taking these practices and using them in ways that can generate ways to collectively use mindfulness to call into question our structural injustices of political systems and build bonds of solidarity, because we're so atomized now. There's the loneliness in society, especially in the United States. It's just almost criminal. So, you know, I think we could find ways to create a more radical civic mindfulness that allows participants to still develop, you know, still work on self-care. I mean, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There are therapeutic benefits to mindfulness, so it's not either or.
So you accept that some people benefit from it in terms of, you know, ameliorating depression or agitation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute about that. The problem with mindfulness isn't that it doesn't work. The problem is that it does work, but in service for whom and whose interest? I think ideologically, if we look at, like, for example, let's look at depression, right? There's nothing wrong with treating depression. The issue is when you consider depression to be strictly a biomedical private disease. It's stripped of any kind of association with the political, social, economic context that people are living in. And I think this is the same with mindfulness. So there's a vested interest, obviously, in the pharmaceutical industry to preserving a worldview that medicalizes depression. So you don't question the environmental or political or social aspects of the disease. And
but mindfulness doesn't figure in the pharmaceutical cornucopia of cures, right? It's anti-pharmaceutical in many ways.
No, it is. Yeah, it is. But it's at the ideological level. It's really how it's maintaining kind of a narrow way of framing human distress.
It's the individual's fault, and it's the individual up to sorting out his or her own issues.
Right. And that's why I'm not disputing that individuals are not. I mean, they're getting benefits from this practice. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so popular. I'm more concerned with the dominant cultural messages. For example, you hear it not just in the mindfulness well-being camp, but you hear it in positive psychology. You hear it in resilience training programs. You know, the focus on the economics of happiness is a big thing. But it's always these programs are always independent of your social conditions. And that's the neoliberal sort of ethos that's underlying these methodologies, that you can just pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and the social and political environments have nothing to do with your happiness or your mental well-being, which is really false.
I'm talking to Dr. Ronald Purser, who has written a book called McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality. One comparison you've made is to the recycling and the anti-litter exhortations in order to make people think that they're doing something and divert attention away from the mass production of plastics by corporations. And I can see what you mean when you say that. So mm-hmm. Would you agree, the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek says that mindfulness is establishing itself as a hegemonic ideology of global capitalism by helping people to fully participate in the capitalist dynamic while retaining the appearance of mental sanity? It sounds like you and he are talking about exactly the same thing.
I think that's fair. Yeah, but I think the recycling thing is absolutely perfect example of how we've been led to believe that our individual actions alone will take care of the environmental crisis, and where we know that plastic manufacturers are off the hook. And the same thing, you could see the same thing in corporate mindfulness programs in a way, because who buys these programs? It's management. I mean, they wouldn't be investing in this if it didn't deliver something to their profit and their bottom line. These are not rank and file people who are all like, hey, let's get a mindfulness program. It's management. And the diagnosis is that, people are stressed out. They're not focusing as well as they should. And so we'll bring in mindfulness, and that'll take care of all the problems that people are experiencing. You know, stress is an incredible problem in the workplace with what, $300 billion of annual losses, as the Gallup poll estimated. Nah, 7 out of 10 people say they're disengaged from their work. So there are problems in a corporation. There are definitely problems. But the diagnosis is, oh, you're just not concentrating well enough. You don't know how to focus. You don't know how to self-regulate. So we have a mindfulness program for you.
You talk about it as if almost as if it's a conspiracy, you know.
I don't think it's a conspiracy.
You don't?
I just think that Paulo Freire, the great critical education scholar, he talked about what he called aspirin practices. And aspirin practices basically put together the naive with the shrewd. And in many ways, I think that's what's happening. I used to be a corporate management consultant, so I know how corporate trainers and consultants, they retool every 5 to 10 years, depending on what's the latest fad out there in the corporate world. And I know people that have done this. So, you know, I think there are financial interests involved that have also spurred this burgeoning corporate mindfulness industry. We have to take into account that the mindfulness industry is an industry. It's $1.5 billion. So it's we do have financial interest here that are driving a lot of this.
Did you become a Zen teacher or practice Zen while you were a corporate management consultant?
Let me think about that. It was before I went to graduate school.
Seems an odd career path then, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm a bit of an oddball out in my college here in College of Business. I really am a misfit. There's no doubt about it. And I felt a lot of cognitive dissonance when I was in
I bet you did.
I really did. I didn't sleep well at night when I was doing consulting engagements. I just didn't know what was bothering me. And, you know, at a certain point, I can't do it anymore. I can't be a corporate enabler. Because I saw that when we were making progress, even when we were making progress in corporations, making them more participative, trying to make them more humanistic and egalitarian, giving more worker autonomy, redesigning work systems so employees had more say, management stopped it, even though it was working. And so that really caused a lot of kind of disenchantment and I realized that this is a larger institutional problem. Our whole corporate structures that are based on turning a profit, maximization of shareholder value, quarterly earnings reporting, you know, all that stuff. Even if you had a CEO that was progressive and wanted to do great things, if they didn't make their numbers, they'd be out.
Are you not a professor of management now?
I am.
So what do you teach?
Well, I teach right now the Introduction to Management course for all undergraduates.
And that's not about making money?
You know, I operate probably in a schizoid way. I try to do my best. And I actually argued with my faculty in my department 10 years ago. I tried to change our curriculum to be much more of a critical liberal arts approach to looking at management. But I lost that battle. So I'm doing the best I can. And I've added a lot of other chapters that normally would not be in the course on ethics. I have them actually read a lot of philosophical text. I have chapters on union organizing, things like that. So, I try to do my best.
Good. I didn't mean to accuse you of hypocrisy.
No, but...
But I guess that was what I was getting at. Okay, so how can we do this? One philosopher says we should be guided by both a concern for appreciating the world as it is and making the world as it ought to be. Mm-hmm. That's the trick, isn't it? How do we do both?
Yeah, I have a quote too. I like the quote by Martin Luther King. He says, true peace is not merely the absence of tension, it's the presence of justice. And so, you know, this whole kind of search for inner peace, I think that's where we lose sight, that our peace may be very, very unstable.
It's very hard to imagine what you've called a radical mindfulness, though. Because radical implies a certain amount of energy and agitation, whereas mindfulness implies the opposite.
Yeah, but I think those could be held in creative tension. I think they could be held in creative tension because if we look at, you know, the nature of suffering, that's one of the key premises of Buddhism is that we all suffer from various causes and conditions. The problem is that the rush to move away from the nature of suffering is a form of escapism in some way. So I think that we have to come to terms with that, but come to terms with it in community rather than in isolation. And so the radical aspect of it is really more just forming deeper connections and communal bonds and reinvigorating civil society. But the neoliberal order has just assaulted that and destroyed basically collectives and unions and the notion of the social. So I think mindfulness, we have to find ways to build collective agency. So we're not just sitting, listening to a meditation app on the subway. We're actually coming together with people and sharing that our various ways that we're suffering. And compassion actually means the suffering with others. So that way we can use mindfulness as kind of building sustainable communities of practice and not see, you know, the model of the self has to expand, that the self is not just some autonomous, separate psychological individual. It's embodied and it's relational and it's situated within its social and economic and historical context. So I think that's a way to, you know, radicalizing sounds really radical, doesn't it? But I don't think it's that radical at all. I think it's just reclaiming what's been taken away from us politically and socially.
You enrolled in a course in mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, which mm-hmm. was designed by the originator of the modern mindfulness movement, who was a chap called Jon Kabat-Zinn. Mm-hmm. And presumably this was for research purposes. What did you do? 8 weeks seems an awfully long time.
Well, that's the standard course. It's an 8-week program, mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, yes.
Unless you're a Californian corporate and you can do it in a day for $12,000, can't you?
Yeah. I was at a conference and I was kind of stunned when one of the consultants told me that they were charging $12,000 a day for senior managers. But yeah, the MBSR course, I signed up for it for a couple of reasons. One is a lot of my detractors were saying, how dare you criticize mindfulness when you've never taken an MBSR course? So I said, okay, well, I guess I need to do that. So I did, and it actually was quite beneficial for everyone there. I say that quite clearly, that I was observing how actually the class was mostly women. I would say probably 80% women. And I was, you know, the first day you don't really talk about what your profession is, but you say why you're there. And most people would share that they lost their job or they're basically, you know, looking for work. They're overstressed. They're working two jobs. Some people had health issues, there's no doubt. But what bothered me was that the trainer basically said all the usual talking points about the explanation for the stresses that people were experiencing. And it just felt a little too convenient that it had, you know, there was no kind of discussion in this course about, oh, you know, I'm stressed at work. Well, what might be the reason for that? Oh, you know, no. We're just going to focus on our breath and we're not going to talk about that. I had a interview with a Dutch journalist a couple months ago, and she took an MBSR course, and she told me that she brought up issues in the course and tried to voice, you know, her concerns that the reasons that were going on in her workplace were causing such burnout and so on. And the mindfulness teacher basically admonished her and said, no, that's really not appropriate for this course. And maybe it's not, of course. But I think that's my point, is that this is how it's ideologically sending a message to people that It's a form of victim blaming at some point when you tell people that it's, you know, you're the problem. You're just not being mindful enough. And if you only were, then, you know, you'd be fine. And I think that's a little too simplistic. You know, we have to consider that meditation was reserved for very elite few monks. A lot of people don't know this. They have the image that all Buddhist monks are meditating or have meditated historically. That's not really true. And when they did, they were supported by the lay community. And they invested thousands and ten thousands of hours in a lifelong process. I mean, they're like spiritual athletes. We're living in the modern world. We hold jobs. So I think that putting all our eggs in one basket, the practice that highly adept monks practice in the Himalayas, and expecting the same results is foolish. So I think we need other ways to kind of deconstruct our notions of the self that use critical intelligence and use critical forms of inquiry. And even in the Buddhist tradition, another methodology was called debate, the vigorous debate on doctrinal points. That was also considered a form of practice. So being Westerners, I think we should find ways to use our intelligent capacities in ways to call into question the fundamental structures of our sense of separation from the world. And whatever ways we can do that, to me, is a skillful means, as they say in Buddhism.
Even if you weren't Buddhist,
right,
would you still be irritated by the modern mindfulness movement on the grounds of, shall we say, politics?
Yes, I would. And you know, this is happening in the field of cultural studies and sociology. You have critics that are critiquing the happiness industry. People are looking at the positive psychology, like Barb and Ehrenreich's classic book. But there are many, many people like that.
I mean, it all seems to be coming back to the same thing, which is it's all a bit of the opiate of the people. Snap out of it and take to the barricades.
Yeah, partly that. I think what's seductive about these techniques and methods is they sound very benign, but we don't see how they function in shaping a particular kind of subjectivity, a particular kind of self in the world. And that kind of gets into more of Michel Foucault's critique of governmentality. He talks about how technologies of self work through, not against our subjectivity. So we're freely choosing these practices, and that's what makes them so seamlessly, you could say, absorbed within our culture.
This commodification of mindfulness then clearly, what's the word, disturbs you?
Disturb?
Does one get, well, you know, you're a Buddhist. Well, do Buddhists get disturbed?
You know, I think at this point, you know, it's to be expected. But when you see Kentucky Fried Chicken creating a commercial called The Comfort Zone with Colonel Sanders sitting on a meditative cushion and trying to sell chicken pot pies, I mean, yeah, I guess that's just the nature of the market. But that's the point. I think that the fact that mindfulness is so market friendly should give us pause in terms of, wait a minute, are we just being kind of turned into better consumers? Are we just kind of accommodating to market forces through these techniques, making us more docile in ways that we may not completely understand?
And that was Ronald Purser, whose book is called Amok Mindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality.